So it's a pleasure to be here again. I was here 7 years ago. 7 years ago, when there was a meeting on quantum Hall effect here at Santa Barbara. So today I'm also going to be talking about, well, I guess what happens in 7 years. I'm still talking about quantum Hall effect, so that hasn't changed. In between, I've become fluent in German. I'm at the Walter Schottky Institute in Munich, and I'm going to describe to you a new type, what I hope is a new type of one-dimensional electron system. I hope I can convince you. And the title is Bending the Quantum Hall Effect by 90 Degrees, Novel 1D Metallic and Insulating Phases. My collaborators were Lucia Steinke, who currently a PhD student in my group. She did the calculations that you'll be seeing, the Hartree calculations in magnetic field, as well as helping me with some experiments. And in the group of Gerhard Obstreiter is where the samples were grown at the Schottky Institute. We did some measurements in Stuttgart and Grenoble, and had some nice discussions with this group of theorists. Let me briefly tell you a little bit about my group. These are some of the folks in the group. These are some of the PhD students I've advised in the past several years, and master's students. And the topics are not limited to quantum Hall effect. We're looking at spintronics applications, studying heavy holes for spintronics applications. We're studying one-dimensional wires, studying new types of growth techniques, etch pattern regrowth, corner overgrowth, which we discuss here, double cleave quantum wires. And so there's a whole variety of interesting physics that we can get at when we study, when we use new types of growth techniques. Okay, let me get back to the talk. I'm going to spend one slide reminding you what the quantum Hall effect is, and then I'll tell you how we make a bent quantum well. When we stick it in a magnetic field, we induce quantum Hall effect on both facets, and we characterize the sample, and I can give you some indication of what the possible phases might be due to Hartree calculations. So, there's probably no need to remind folks in the audience what the quantum Hall effect is, but nonetheless, let me review which aspects are important for this work. So you know that in the bulk of a two-dimensional electron system, when you apply a perpendicular magnetic field, you induce an energy gap. Let's ignore spin and consider this to be the Landau gap in the bulk of the sample. And if you occupy, if your Fermi energy sits in the middle of your gap, then you have a so-called filling factor, which counts the number of occupied states in the bulk. For each set of Landau levels that are occupied at the edge of the sample, there will be a confining potential which keeps the electrons inside of your sample. And this confining potential will lift the binding energy of each Landau level close to the edge, and you will get what's a so-called edge state where you can have low energy excitations. The electric field which binds the electrons is perpendicular to the magnetic field normal to the sample. So you get an E cross B drift, and as shown here, the electrons effectively propagate in chiral channels flowing out of the page. So the top view of the sample would look like this. Once again, the bulk is incompressible, and we have these low energy modes at the edge which propagate chirally around the sample. So we have a chiral 1D system, and once again, the number of edge modes is identically the filling factor. I can measure what this current is by using the Landauer-Brüdiger formalism, and the current which passes next to a ohmic contact is proportional to the voltage at that contact, proportional by the coefficient of the number of edge modes times the conductance quantum. So if I want to know how much current is passing a given point, all I do is measure the voltage at that point with a voltage probe. Bert Halperin showed in 1982 that for the simple single particle edges that I've shown in this manner, filling factors 1, 2, and 3, the 1D system is a one-dimensional Fermi liquid, and the excitations are effectively electrons. Xiaogang Wen showed in 1990 that if you have a many-particle gap, for example, the nu equals 1/3 effect, and interactions are defining your incompressible state in the bulk, then your edge is a Luttinger liquid, which has, for example, a power law and the tunneling density of states and other properties that are non-Fermi liquid-like. So the last thing that I want to mention, these are all sort of microscopic and macroscopic pictures of my quantum Hall effect, but what does the measurement actually look like? This is the longitudinal four-point resistance as a function of magnetic field. And I've highlighted these red regions here where the longitudinal resistance goes down to zero. And this indicates when my Fermi energy is inside of this gapped region. So wherever it's red here, that means that my Fermi energy is sitting in a gap, my bulk is incompressible, and the chiral flow of current around the periphery is lossless, therefore zero resistance. So for all of the data that I'll be showing in the future of this talk, the important aspect is that we can only draw one of these types of pictures with chiral modes given that the resistivity is at zero. So this is my summary of the quantum Hall effect. So let me tell you how we make a bent quantum well. So we start with a 110 substrate. Gallium arsenide high mobility samples are not usually grown on this facet, but this facet has a special advantage, and that advantage is that the 110 class facet is also the cleave facet. So therefore, I can take a 110 substrate piece and I can cleave it in the 1-1 direction. These are orthogonal to each other because the Miller indices dot product is zero. However, they are of the same crystal class, which means gallium arsenide is not always gallium arsenide. There's 110 gallium arsenide. There's 001 gallium arsenide. Different facets require different growth conditions in order to grow optimally. And so the nice thing about these two orthogonal facets, they belong to the same crystal class, so that when I grow some material on them, I can get a very high mobility interface. So let's grow your standard heterostructure, which is to say, first we lay down some fresh MBE gallium arsenide topped by a barrier of aluminum gallium arsenide with a layer of doping in between. Then we know that this is the standard heterojunction. The electrons in the dopant layer can lower their energy by going to the hetero interface, and we form a 2D electron system. I should mention that the nomenclature for these two facets, I call this a substrate because this is the facet that's been polished by the manufacturer when he gives us the wafer. And I call this the pre-cleave, borrowing the notation of Lauren Pfeiffer at Bell Labs, because we have cleaved the sample ex situ, outside of the growth chamber, in atmosphere, in oxygen. I like to breathe oxygen when I'm working in the lab. And then I break the sample, mount it at 45 degrees, and then insert it into the growth chamber. So we call it pre-cleave because it was cleaved before inserting into the chamber. In the remainder of the talk, all of the electrons associated with this facet will be with subscript S for substrate, and over here subscript P for pre-cleave. In order to contact these electrons, I'm going to stick little blobs of indium on the edges and at
was that not pre-cleaved?
That's right. So the question is, what is the difference between cleaved edge overgrowth in this type of a situation? With cleaved edge overgrowth, that's the reason Lauren invented this nomenclature. Cleave means cleaved in situ. Pre-cleave means cleaved ex situ. Because when Lauren Pfeiffer does cleaved edge overgrowth, he cleaves the sample and then regrows, and then he's interested in the high mobility properties of that interface. Now, what I didn't explicitly show you here, but I said briefly, is that when we do this pre-cleave, the electrons are actually not sitting at the interface that was cleaved. We first grow a buffer layer, followed by MBE-grown gallium arsenide, and then we grow this interface. So any interface which has ever been exposed to air will never be high mobility, probably will never even host a 2D electron system. So this regrowth requires that we have many, many, many layers before we hit this gallium arsenide layer here. And the question that's most relevant for all that will follow, how sharp is this corner? So this is a scanning electron micrograph, and you can see this is a test structure just because it's easy to see bands of aluminum arsenide in a scanning electron microscope picture. So we have dark aluminum arsenide and light gallium arsenide, and when we zoom in on this corner, you can see that down to the resolution of the electron microscope, which is about 10 nanometers, we really do have a sharp corner. And you see that that exists even all the way out here after several microns of growth. So it's the sharpness of this corner which is going to be giving us the new physics. So then let me introduce you the bent quantum well. This is what it looks like under a microscope. We have about a 4 millimeter long, several millimeter long sample. These are the indium blobs that I told you about with gold wires attached to them. And the corner is right here, bent. We can stick this sample in a tilted magnetic field in order to induce different filling factors on the two facets. For this particular experiment, we will always align the magnetic field so that we get equal filling factors or equal number of edge states on each facet. Let me show you the characteristic. The four-point measurements within a given facet look as follows. You see that you have a very well-developed quantum Hall effect. These incompressible states that I told you about, which allow you to draw this type of a picture, occur very nicely at filling factors 1 and 2, etc. And we're still at a fairly high temperature. When we lower the temperature more, we'll also see this effect in the fractional regime. You can see that the densities are different between the pre-cleave and substrate sides. The substrate side is a slightly lower density, and the pre-cleave mobility is also a little bit worse. Look at how the two-thirds gap is large here, the gap is too small here, but here we've almost got a well-defined incompressible state. And even though the densities are different, all I have to do is a little bit of trigonometry, and I can determine how to get equal filling factors on both facets just by choosing the appropriate tilt angle of my magnetic field. So let's do that. Let's put this thing in a magnetic field and study the conductance properties of this corner. So before I do that, let me give you a quick synopsis of what we might see. First off, what does a generic 1D system look like? Well, we have forward movers and reverse movers. We have backscattering in between them. We force some current through the sample, and we measure the voltage. Thereby, we can measure the conductance and the conductivity, the 1D conductivity. So if we have a system of two quantum Hall effects that are brought next to each other so close that they're able to couple, we could consider this dotted line here to surround an equivalent system, a one-dimensional system. we would apply a voltage across the sample, or force a current through the sample at voltage Vs, and that would inject some current, part of which would be transmitted through the wire, but part of which would be backscattered in these backscattering events and would come out the top here. Now, how are we going to measure these quantities like conductance? Well, if we measure what I call the cross-corner voltage, this voltage is proportional to the input current. This voltage is proportional to the backscattered current. So their difference is proportional to the wire current by the same factor. So it means that this cross-corner voltage, VCC, is actually proportional to the conductance of this wire. And the final formula looks as follows. You simply divide the wire current divided by the applied voltage Vs, and that is your conductance. So to give you some intuition, it's a little bit weird that I'm able to measure the conductance along this wire by measuring this voltage drop here. So let me show you that that actually makes intuitive sense. Let's pretend that we had broken this system so that we have a perfect conductor, so that all of the injected current into the wire comes out the bottom end. Well, in that case, VCC is equal to VS, and then we get the scenario that the conductance of the wire is equal to the conductance of the contacts, which is a well-known result. Alternate case, let's pretend that the wire doesn't conduct at all, and all of the current that passes through here goes across here, therefore VCC is zero and the conductance is zero. So that explains our conductance formula. Okay, let's check to make sure that we've got the sample oriented at the right magnetic field. So I'm going to send the current across the corner and then measure RXX with these voltage contacts within a given facet. And you see that sure enough, my integer filling factors are all lined up and my fractional filling factors are nicely lined up. So I've chosen my angle correctly. And we see now that we're at base temperature of 30 millikelvin, even at 2/3, we have a well-defined incompressible state in the bulk. Now let's measure the cross-corner voltages between BC and EF. And immediately you notice that some of these filling factors, something different happens. We have a finite voltage drop at filling factors 3, 4, 5, and 6. And this indicates that the current that's flowing past contact B is greater than the current that's flowing past contact C. Therefore, VBC is positive. Therefore, we have a positive resistance in these units. So that, where can the current go? Well, it can't go into the bulk because we've just measured that the bulk is incompressible. The only remainder is that this sharp corner edge must be forming some sort of boundary which transmits current. And finally, let me point out that the fractional effect also shows interesting conductance of the same nature along the corner. So we have backscattering along this corner. Now comes the question, what is the nature of this wire? I have to rely once again on this scanning electron micrograph to tell me that the width of this channel is much smaller than all the other length scales in the problem, and therefore I have a one-dimensional corner. So, for example, the resolution shows that the curvature is at least smaller than 10 nanometers. Well, at 23 Tesla, the highest magnetic field we're able to achieve, the magnetic length is 5 nanometers. So that means that the sharpness of this corner is sharper than the size of the diameter of my ground energy orbit. So therefore, for this entire range of magnetic field where I will have larger magnetic lengths, this corner really is perceived as a sharp one-dimensional bend. So therefore, we say the system must be one-dimensional. So now let's apply the conductance formula which I derived previously, and let's plot all of this data in terms of this conductance. But now, instead of plotting it against a magnetic field, I'm going to plot it against 1 over magnetic field, which is filling factor. So here's the same data, and now I'm going to throw away all of the data where the facets are compressible, because it makes no sense that I'm not measuring any 1D properties. But for these ranges of magnetic field and a filling factor, I have an incompressible facet and therefore a 1D propagation along the corner. And you see a certain pairwise behavior, filling factors 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, show the same type of behavior. Empirically, we can explain that if we assume that spin plays no role in the scattering, because we have here filling factors 1 and 2 are both associated with the lowest orbital Landau level, but with different spin polarization and on up. What happened with 7 is this is a Zeeman split gap, and the magnetic field is too low. Basically, the easiest to so if we go to the previous trace, 7 is here, so they don't join yet. This facet doesn't go to 0, and if these facets would, by the laws of current conservation, require that voltage BC is equal to voltage VF if the facets are incompressible. So you can either say that the RXX does not go to 0, or you can say that these two traces do not touch each other. In either case, you do not have a well-defined 1D state at nu equals 7. But nu equals 8, you do recover it because this is a Landau gap instead of a spin gap. Okay, so I'm going to be building up this table through the course of the talk. For now, we've made the following observation. We believe we have a 1D conductor at the corner at filling factors 1/3, as well as 3, 4, 5, and 6. We have some sort of conducting state at high magnetic fields and at low magnetic fields. And at intermediate magnetic fields, we have an insulating state. So now it's interesting to look at the length dependence, because if we have the question, if this is truly a one-dimensional system, then the scattering, it should have diffusive transport, and we should have multiple scattering events along distributed along the length of the wire. So if we have a long wire like this, 4.2 millimeters long, we should have a low conductance. And here you see, for example, this is only a fraction of a percent of the conductance quantum for filling factors 3 and 4. I should mention as an aside, this is now a second sample, a different sample, so we have observed this in multiple systems, in multiple samples. So now when I reduce the size of that sample by scratching it away, reducing it in size by an order of magnitude, one would expect that the conductance of the wire should go inversely with the length, so a shorter sample should have a higher 1D conductance because of less opportunity to backscatter. Sure enough, the conductance increases. And if you want to make that quantitative, this is the about one order of magnitude reduction in length gives us about one order of magnitude increase in the conductance. So we do have first evidence of a linear or of a distributed set of scatterers along the length of this wire. We can go one step further and say that the 1D conductivity can be defined in terms of a number of forward and reverse pairs times some mean free path times the conductance quantum. And we can then determine what is this mean free path. And the value that we get is about 7 microns for filling factors 3 and 4, and about 27 microns for filling factor 6. In this sample, the spin splitting in filling factor 5 was too small, and we were unable to observe the effect here. So this sort of makes sense to the extent we know that however many channels we have for propagation, at these filling factors. When we increase the filling factor, we should have more channels. So to that extent, N increases. Therefore, it makes sense that the NL product at filling factor 6 should be qualitatively larger than for 3 and 4. So to be explicit as to what we've learned from that last data set, we were able to determine a 1 over L dependence of the length of the conductor at filling factors 3 through 6 in the integer effect. The insulating state was the conductance was too low for us to be able to make any clear length dependence. And the 1/3 effect, it's unfortunately a bit difficult to get measurement time at Grenoble, so we were unable to complete that experiment. But that's one thing that we would like to do, is fill out this table and measure these length dependences in future experiments. So the final experimental data that I'll be showing is in the next section, where we take this 1D wire system and we apply an energy scale, temperature or voltage, and try to figure out what kind of 1D state it is. So I'm going to sit at these specific filling factors right in the center of these plateaus, at 1/3, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then I'm going to change the temperature, and I'm going to see what happens to this conductance, if it goes up or down or what as a function of temperature. So the base temperature values are here and way off scale for the insulator. And you see that the filling factors 1 and 2, which showed no conductance up till now, at finite temperature, they start to show a finite conductance. Filling factors 3 and 4, which showed a moderate conductance at base temperature, show a very weak increase in the conductance with temperature. And perhaps the most striking result is the Nu equals 1/3 metal, which shows that with decreasing temperature, we get increasing conductance. And so I label these states as metallic for the 1/3 case, and insulating for the Nu equals 1 and Nu equals 2. And I call this case critical just to differentiate between the two other cases to the extent that the weak temperature dependence, if there were some sort of phase transition, it is reminiscent of a critical behavior. So the striking thing here is that the one sample gives us five different data sets that show three qualitatively different behaviors. So we can change the character of the 1D system by just going to a different filling factor. Do we see the 1/3 in two different samples? We have only been able to measure one sample with the 1/3 effect up to date. If you think about it, the 1/3 effect, you need an extremely large magnetic field here, because you're projecting 1 over root 2 of the magnetic field is the normal component. So however, if you got 18 tesla of your normal component, you need 18 tesla times square root of 2 for the total B field. So we need Grenoble or Tallahassee or Nijmegen, these types of things, to do these measurements. The other energy scale we can apply to the system is the DC voltage. And once again, you see three qualitatively different behaviors. For Nu equals 1 and 2, the so-called insulator, it behaves as you would expect at low excitations. The thing is simply insulating. At large excitations, you start to see some conductance. At the metallic behavior, filling factor 1/3, there are four different temperature plots here. The lowest temperature is 60 millikelvin on top, and then 85, 120, and 170. The peak positions, or the peak values of these four conductances is highlighted on the previous plot as squares. You can see on the log-log plot of the temperature dependence, the black squares. So this effectively tells you where is the temperature dependence coming from. It's coming from the low energy behavior. the high energy tails of your conductance show very little change with increasing temperature, but the central peak rapidly drops. And finally, the so-called critical phase, where we have nu equals 3 and nu equals 4, there's an odd non-monotonic behavior. At nu equals 3, the conductance at first rises as you increase the voltage from 0, and then very slowly decreases. No, because we believe that what's happening here is right. We have a huge length dependence, and because we're in the diffusive limit, right. If we had a quantum point contact with a single tunnel event, then we would expect the crossover voltage to be equal to the temperature. But exactly. I think we can use the ratio of this voltage crossover to kT to determine something about the length, the effective length of the system. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to modify the table in the next slide to define these conducting phases now as metallic, insulating, and critical. And this slide, this concludes the strictly experimental part of the talk, where all I'm referring, just describing the data and showing you what we've measured. What I'm going to do in the remainder, with my remainder of the time, is I'm going to discuss what could possibly be causing this by doing some comparing with literature of similar systems, as well as doing Hartree calculations. But at this point, we have a nu equals 1/3 metallic state, nu equals 1/2 insulator, and 3, 4, 5, 6 critical phase. Okay, so let's do a Hartree calculation of this system to see what we might have. So at B equals 0, we just have some dopants and this corner potential. When we calculate the total charge density, it's the solid blue line here, you can see that there's a markedly enhanced density right at the corner. This charge density is plotted as a function of distance from the corner. And we see that when we do the calculation, there's one particular state that lives just at the corner, which accounts for most of the charge density at that corner. And this single state, which I've shown here with the blue dotted line, this single state has an energy which is significantly lower than all of the other solutions to our Hartree solver. So we call this state one-dimensional because it's very deeply bound and it has a line width which is of order the Fermi wavelength. So we have a 1D density in this state, and then if we subtract that away, we can deduce a 2D density. All the remainder of the electrons give you a density which looks like the dashed line, the blue dashed line. So what you can see, for example, first off, the 2D density, the 2D states are all within 4 millielectron volts of the Fermi energy, whereas the 1D state is bound 7 MeV deep. You can even see that the Hartree solver correctly estimates Friedel oscillations. The corner acts as a sharp boundary, which gives you these oscillatory components in the charge density at the KF over 2. So that's all at zero magnetic field. So the surprise here was that even at zero magnetic field, there appears to be a native 1D state that lives at this corner. So let's see what happens when we apply a magnetic field. So we're going to take the Hartree potential encapsulates both of these terms, the electron-electron interactions plus the crystal potential. Let's add to that now a harmonic oscillator which represents our magnetic field. And so omega C is the magnetic field strength, and X naught is the cyclotron orbit center coordinate. And then we can plot a dispersion, we can calculate a dispersion as a function of the orbit center coordinate. And you see this band dispersion here. It doesn't take too much imagination to recognize something from the beginning of the talk, which is a single quantum Hall edge. If we take this electron system and treat it as just being bound at this corner by this hard wall, you would get a dispersion which would look like this, which would have edge channels coming out of the page at the Fermi energy, which is here 0 millielectron volts. And then you could associate these other dispersion band with this other set of 2D electrons. And then what remains is the deeply bound wire, which once again, as I said, is about 7 MeV deep compared to about 3 or 4 MeV deep of the 2D electron system. And this parabolic dispersion also has a forward and reverse mover. And so the coupling between these states gives you anti-crossings everywhere that these dispersions meet. And just as a reminder, for this simplified calculations, we're neglecting spin and just treating the orbital degree of freedom. So we have this hybridized 1D system. This is sufficient to explain, perhaps, what might be going on in filling factors 3 and 4. We just have some multimode wire. There are several channels which are scattering amongst themselves. You can see that the disorder potential, you can map the cyclotron orbit center coordinate in X to a K vector in Y along the translationally invariant direction. And the disorder potential would scatter from, say, these reverse movers to these forward movers, or these reverse movers to these reverse movers, or et cetera. Any pair would give an opportunity for scattering off of the disorder potential. So if that's a multimode wire, what other phases could we possibly explain with these simple calculations? Let me point out one other column that I want to add here. I want to ask the question in this final column, which is called interactions, or interactions, is the model which we propose for explaining a given behavior, does it rely on interactions in order to explain the physics? And given that it's a single particle picture, certainly it is a Hartree picture, but given that it's basically single electron physics, it's not necessary to have interactions to be able to explain this critical behavior. Okay, so what other phases can be explained? Well, at low fields, we have a very weak coupling, very weak anti-crossing between these two modes in the red circle. At high fields, we have a very large coupling and a large anti-crossing. And so, can we explain this? Well, it makes sense because at low magnetic fields, we have a large magnetic length, and that means that the semi-classical cyclotron motion of our skipping orbit is going to have a large radius, and the skipping orbit will spend a very small fraction of its time in the neighborhood of this corner, where it would notice that it could lower its kinetic energy by spilling probability into this other facet. So therefore, the coupling between these two systems will be very low at low magnetic fields. However, as we increase the magnetic field, the magnetic length becomes smaller, and the electron, the skipping orbit, spends a larger percentage of its time within the corner, in the neighborhood of the corner, and so it will couple more strongly to the state on the opposite facet. hence the increased anti-crossing gap, which falls out of the Hartree calculations. If we keep going with this, you can see how at sufficiently high magnetic fields, like 4 Tesla here in the bottom right, you can see that the anti-crossing gap will become so large that you can run the Fermi, candidate Fermi energy across the system, and the Fermi energy would never intersect the dispersion at the corner. So you've effectively created an anti-crossing gap, and you have a gapped 1D state at the corner. So there is no more wire at the corner due to the anti-crossing. So the coupling could be one candidate reason for the 1D insulating state, this anti-crossing gap. Alternately, and perhaps in a more standard fashion, it could be that we do in fact have 1D states which live at the corner, but that at sufficiently, we know that all 1D states should be localized according to the standard theory. So those are the two main candidates for explaining this 1D insulator. They give us, yes, they predict the splitting. Yes, to the extent that here at 4 Tesla, we see that the splitting here is large enough that above 4 Tesla we would certainly have a gap. And if you look at the table, the insulating state that we observe experimentally is in this range of magnetic field. So it's conceivable. As we discussed previously, if you actually try to deduce what would be the gap size from an activated behavior, the gap is actually much smaller than the one that we calculate here. But as you see here, this gap size is much smaller than this coupling. So it's an open question. At this point, these are the candidate models. Once again, the level anti-crossing does not require interactions, nor does localization theory require interactions in order to create a 1D insulating state. So up until now, all of the physics that we observe can be explained as 1D single particle picture. So now comes the question about 1D metallic behavior. As I said before, the localization theory predicts that all 1D states would be insulators in the presence of disorder. The only way that, or we know that we have repulsive interactions, and repulsive interactions should actually make a stronger insulator. But it turns out there's an alternative way in the presence of repulsive interactions which can still lead to metallic behavior. And this work was based on the phase diagram mapped out in 1D disorder by Gemarkey and Schultz, but Ren and Orovis and Kane and Fisher both explained how you could have a chiral Luttinger liquid, which is a filling factor 1/3 chiral edge, if it's coupled to a counterpropagating 1/3 edge only via electron tunneling. And if there's some reason why quasi-particle tunneling can be excluded from the problem, for example, if you had a vacuum between these two quantum Hall droplets, then only electron tunneling is allowed, and electron tunneling is irrelevant, which is to say at low temperatures and low voltages, there's a power loss suppression to the tunneling due to the density of states within each of these two droplets. So, whereas at high temperatures, you could imagine that there's a finite amount of tunnel coupling between these two systems. If you go to zero temperature, this mechanism of charge backscattering, of tunneling forward movers into reverse movers, is disallowed. And you recover at the zero temperature limit a perfect conductor. All the charge that you supply will make it all the way through ballistically without scattering. And that is capable of explaining this type of increasing conductance with decreasing temperature, the so-called anti-wire model. And so finally, this is the final slide showing this table where we have, in the one-third case, we cannot explain this behavior with a simple single particle picture. We propose that there must interactions must be brought into the problem somehow to explain the physics, which makes sense because the quasi-particle gap that's making this one-dimensional system at the corner is itself caused by interactions. That's the one-third state. And this is one model candidate to explain that behavior. And so finally, let me conclude. I hope that I've demonstrated for you a 1D system bound at the corner of a bent quantum Hall effect. We've measured the conductance as a function of filling factor. We can deduce the mean free path for certain filling factors. And we can tune three different behaviors. In particular, the metallic behavior is novel for 1D systems in this limit, with where you have truly single quantum channels in each direction. So thank you very much for your attention. So the question was, so if you have two counterpropagating one-dimensional channels at the corner, if the interaction is sufficiently strong, even at one-third, then you should get an insulator, insulating behavior. Is that correct? To some extent, I would agree, because, let's see, I believe it depends on the strength of the disorder, how the disorder couples. What Giammarchi and Schultz show is that you need to have sufficiently strong, in their case, attractive interactions, a sufficiently large Luttinger K parameter in order to overcome the disorder. And I believe basically what disorder does is it renormalizes the K parameter as you scale the problem to lower and lower temperatures, say, the K value changes slightly. Now, according to their model, if you start with K equals 3, which is this Luttinger, this nu equals one-third system, you would always stay in the limit of metallic behavior. You would not cross over into an insulator. But if you want to fit, let's see, where is the data? If you want to fit this value roughly to an exponent, our exponent is too low to be explained by Giammarchi. As far as Giammarchi and Schultz is concerned, this exponent, which is about minus one-half, is below the metal insulator transition, and eventually this thing should go insulating. So it's unclear right now exactly why we sit here with this weak exponent when Giammarchi and Schultz say that we should have a much steeper slope. So it is correct that this one could go insulating. We need to go to lower temperatures and study more systems to find out.
So remind me, critical value.
Yeah, we're below that. We could be on the insulating side. which means that this order will be, keep becoming more and more relevant as we go to lower and lower temperatures. And this, if you want to call this a temperature-dependent power law, then it's going to keep getting lower and lower and lower and eventually change sign. Speculation. I would my answer is no. Okay, so let me repeat the question for posterity. So the question was, can you make an equivalent planar system at all? To what we're seeing here. And I would say the answer is no. Let me show you what the wave functions look like that are associated with these forward and reverse movers. So let's start. Okay, this blue dot is the Landau, is the Fermi point of this edge state here. And you can see the wave function shown here has a single node and strongly overlaps in real space with its symmetric counterpart from the other facet. As I increase, as I go to the next highest Landau index here, this guy, I add one more node to my quantum mechanical solution, and the wave function, the skipping orbit, tends to spread further and further into the facet where it came from. And once again, to the next highest guy, we get 1, 2, 3 nodes extending even further into the facet. But there's always a finite overlap at the corner. And finally, there's this 1D state here. With three facets at a corner,
yeah.
you could get some new physics.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, so I would say, first off, if I have a two-dimensional system, let me answer the first part of I can give you my opinion as to the answer to the first part of the question. Can you simulate, or is this system just a planar system with some fancy boundary conditions? I would say no, it's not. I would say it's fundamentally three-dimensional, or at least two-dimensional with one dimension of translational invariance, because you cannot create some sort of boundary that's going to lift up the spectrum you cannot create a quantum Hall edge for someone on the left half and then create another quantum Hall edge for the guys on the right half and have those wave functions interpenetrate in real space if it's in a planar system. So I think that the quantum mechanical solution to this 2D problem does, in a magnetic field, is fundamentally different. And as far as the question of if you add another facet to have, you know, three facets at 90 degrees relative to each other, I agree that there's going to be some interesting topologies in that system, which would certainly not map to a planar system. So the question is, if going to the case of the multi-channel wires, which is like filling factors 3, 4, 5, and 6, the conductance of the 1D system is already well below, well here, this plot should be good enough. The conductance of the 1D system is of order 1% of the conductance quantum. How can you possibly reconcile that with the fact that it's not localized? Why, I guess, so I cannot explicitly answer that question because basically I'm observing what I see here. You could argue that there's some very weak localizing going on. The temperature dependence is quite weak here, but over this one order of magnitude in temperature, there's not much change in the conductance. One would just expect that at zero temperature, this thing would eventually hit zero. I cannot explain. Let me ask, would you expect that you would have a sharper insulating behavior than this very, very weak slope? Is that part, basically your question? Why is the slope so shallow for this? Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that we're sort of seeing this behavior here. If this behavior were strongly exponential, then I think we would also see an exponential behavior in the length dependence. I think that if we can measure this state, for example, length dependence of this state, then I think we will start to see that both, right now we have temperature and voltage, which are showing similar behavior. I think what we would see is that temperature, voltage, and length would all be different for all three phases. So that's an experiment that we're hoping to do. We do not have length dependence of this guy just because we only measured length dependence at base temperature. And unfortunately, this data is well below the resolution of our experiment. So we will have to design a specific experiment to look for length dependence here. And I think the reason that the length dependence looked ohmic for this filling factors 3 and 4 is because the temperature dependence looks basically ohmic. There's almost no temperature dependence. Okay, thanks.